Blog Talk Radio.
Happy New Year. Welcome to another reality show. I am your host, Golden Hawk, and I am feeling fabulous. Yes, I am. Yesterday, I felt like a tsunami was running through my being. A lot of energy. Oh, my God. A lot of energy running through my whole body, physically, emotionally, mentally. And, you know, as I posted on Facebook, after the storm, the rainbows, I feel clear. I feel light. I feel like there was a tremendous release that happened for me yesterday. And, you know, for that, I'm of course, genuinely grateful, because releasing is absolutely a part of this game that we are playing as being human beings on planet Earth right now. You know, on our way to becoming human angels, there is releasing that needs to be done that didn't take place, you know, initially when we were deeply embedded, so to speak, in the duality of it all. So the releasing is definitely, it's a big part of it. And, you know, one thing I'd like to definitely emphasize is that the releasing is not about, you don't release something and not feel it. To genuinely release an emotion or to release an energy that's been, you know, kind of within us, not kind of, that is within us. First you feel it, and the releasing is you don't attach a story to it. You just allow yourself to feel it, let it go, and then know that it's a done deal. It's a done deal. That chapter, that moment, that experience, close the book, you know, shake your hands. Okay, finished. Let's do another thing. You know, let's experience another moment, so to speak. Because I know a lot of my friends, sometimes when they start feeling things, they're like, I have already worked on this. I don't know why I'm feeling this. And there's layers to us. I mean, we are definitely like that onion. There is layers upon layers of emotions that we have buried since our childhood. And as the frequencies are rising on the planet, it's pushing all of it up to the surface, and it's saying, you know, the time is ripe. I mean, we are the ripe apple that is just falling off the tree effortlessly. And the emotions that came up out of me yesterday were definitely passionate. I mean, I was raging, hands down. I was raging. And I don't feel guilty about it. I was speaking my truth. And ironically, the reason also why that I know that this is all different for me is everyone that I was raging at is all okay with me today. I'm okay with them today. It just seemed like this energy was passing through me and my dad and my brother. You know, God bless family. They really know how to grab that karmic stuff and pull it out of you. So, you know, I definitely feel great today. I feel great. We're going to have a great show, and I'm totally stoked because I see my guest is on the on my switchboard. And before I bring on the amazing William Whitecloud, I just want to do what we always do and call in our essence. And I'm going to call in my essence, and I'm going to welcome you guys to call in your essence. So let's take a few deep breaths. And invite in our essence to join us in our physical beings. It's just an invitation. We're not begging and pleading. Our souls and our essence don't need to be begged and pleaded. I'm not quite sure the essence of this, why we have to invite our essence in, but I know since inviting my essence in, it has changed everything. I mean, it really does make the experience of whatever I'm going through, I can easily tap into the bigger picture. And when I can tap into the bigger picture, things definitely make more sense than when I'm just a human being in a body. And your essence will bring in the wisdom of the bigger picture. Like I said, I don't know how light switches work, but I know if you flip the switch, the light goes on. If you invite your essence in, it will absolutely help you in every situation you're dealing with, from the mundane to the profound. And I know for me, just inviting in my essence just relaxes me, and, you know, just doing it right now, I can feel it immediately. My hands and my arms and my legs, they get a warmth that comes over them, and it feels like my cells breathe deeper. That's the best way for me to explain it from a physical level, but that's how it feels to me. And it's fabulous. Hey, and it's free. You don't need an education. You can't be denied. You just keep inviting your essence in. Your essence shows up, and it really is a wonderful teacher, truly a wonderful teacher. So with that being said, let's invite in the guest now. So many of you have heard the other two shows that me and William Whitecloud have done. We have discussed his wonderful book called The Magician's Way. And what we're doing is, within the book, he discusses seven magical steps. And we have actually, or excuse me, seven magical secrets. We have discussed the first three, so we're just going to keep picking up from where we left off. And so let's get him on the show. Welcome to the show, William. Thank you for coming tonight.
Hi, Galvin. How are you going?
I'm doing fabulous, as you probably just heard.
Yeah.
How are you?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I'm actually in deep mourning, you know, for two reasons. My father-in-law, who was a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends, and my wife's father, just died a few days ago, so that's very sad, something we're dealing with at the moment. And
well, I'm very sorry.
Thanks. It's very sad. And also, 5 minutes before the show started, Australia just lost the Ashes. It's our most significant international sporting event when England plays Australia cricket, in a test matches that we have against each other. And
right.
Australia has just lost the series. We've just been thrashed. So the whole country, no doubt, is in mourning. You know, it's worse than anyone passing away, even. So,
wow.
You know, not...
Well, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate that you're staying committed to this. And if you need to go, I honor that.
No, thanks, but I'm cool, you know. I'm okay with loss. That's fine. You know, I just caught your little speech on releasing, you know, and it was very touching for me at this moment, because you know, I think that I'm actually not really that fond of holding on to anything. I'm not, you know, attached to holding on to anything. And also at the same time, I think, you know, powerful healing, releasing comes from accepting and deeply appreciating, you know, any process, including the loss process or the mourning process. I remember, because I grew up in Africa, you know, and I witnessed many times, especially when I was a kid, you know, in the mid-50s, women were still giving birth. I was born in the mid-50s, right? So, I wasn't very conscious of what was going on in the mid-50s. But let's say still in the mid-60s, you know, when I was fully conscious and aware of what was going on and part of life around me, women even then were still giving birth to about 15 children in their lifetime in that area, and only three of them would survive to the age of 20. You know, so if you're a woman,
wow,
you would lose 12 of your children before, you know, they reached adulthood. And as a result, I saw many African women grieving, you know, and I saw the whole, I was, you know, party to and part of, a witness to the whole grieving process. And I think it's a beautiful thing, and I learned a lot from it, and I carry a lot from that experience, where what would happen is, I'd be at a hospital, for instance, or at a clinic or something, and a baby would be pronounced dead. And the mother would just collapse, and just lie on the floor and kick and scream and wail and, in a sense, just totally surrender to that emotion, to that experience, and it would be amplified by all the other women also joining in. And, they would, bang their heads against a wall and kick and scream and lie on the floor and writhe and scream and wail and, just absolutely cathart, I guess is the word. And, but really genuinely, it wasn't a false show, it was a real just immersion in that emotion of loss and grief and whatever. And it used to carry on for up to half an hour, and was almost terrible to watch. But then they just suddenly get up and dust themselves off, and wipe their eyes, and then that was it. I mean, I literally saw women go back to work in the fields. And then there was no one else outside of themselves compelling them to go on with their work, or normally in our society we'd take a few weeks off or something like that. But they just got straight back to work, and it was finished. It was done, because they did in that, they did in that half hour what we do, over days or weeks or months or years even. And, it's a very powerful release. And I actually, it's not like I enjoy it in the sense that, there's any part of me that's glad for it to have happened, but I do appreciate the opportunities to experience loss and to mourn and to have that experience. It's not anything I want to escape, and so I'm just glad I've got that attitude to that, and my wife also shares that attitude with me, and it's not something we want to get over. It's not something we want to run away from. We want to be, in a sense, feel like we need to be released from. But by accepting that and appreciating that part of the human journey, I think then it is a very healthy and powerful release to just really, for something to be released. I don't think it's a getting rid of. It's partly, a claiming and an acceptance, and then alchemically, then obviously that then doesn't give that vibration power, so it doesn't have power, and that's the clean, healthy release, and certainly a sporting occasion is just sport. What the hell, sometimes I just laugh at how immature it is that the people can be so identified with a side as if their honor and their life and their pride and their abilities ride on what somebody else has done. We don't even know these guys. I've never even met these 11 guys that played for us, and we can go on as if they are us, and it's just sometimes so ridiculous. But it's good fun, it's good human fun, I think, to have a side and feel these emotions and vicarious emotions, as long as we don't get too carried away by it, and people can, there'll no doubt be fights outside the stadium, and particularly tonight in bars in Sydney, there'll be English supporters there, and there'll be Australians worked up, and can be guaranteed that through the day there'll be some fights in the streets and fights tonight, and that's right, when it just becomes ridiculous,
Right. Well, it's patriotism and the love of a sport. seem very similar in energy and consciousness. You know, supporting, you know, I see people, you know, that the supporting of a country, the supporting of a team, in my personal opinion, it's, you know, it's this ultimate giving of power away for the benefit of being part of a group. You know, it's the group consciousness that they benefit from, but that whole individual aspect is surrendered when, you know, when you're getting into a fight because your team loses, or when you're going to die for your country. You know, these are from my person, you know, and I'm not saying there's not honor in it, but from my personal level of consciousness, I'm willing to die. It's not about the not being willing to die, but I'm willing to die for things that I believe in, and my beliefs don't necessarily support my government's beliefs.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's just, you know, at that level, I think, you know, what you're talking about, it's just ego, you know, rather than heart. If I'm in my heart, you know, there's absolutely no identification with the game,
right,
other than the love of the game, you know, and,
right,
and appreciation of a good game and you know, the honor of a sport well played and whatever. But when it goes beyond that, then you know, it's just ego, isn't it? And personally,
yeah.
I'm sure there are things that I would die for from my heart, but not something that my ego is going to be attached to and rally around. I wouldn't want to die for something like that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I really do appreciate you being here tonight. I mean, I always enjoy our conversations, and I am open to speaking on whatever feels right to speak on tonight. You know, this isn't about a scripted show, or, you know, we have to discuss the secrets. You know what I'm saying? We're organic. We're both, you know, intelligent, organic speakers, and, you know, I really am open taking this anywhere you want to take it.
Oh, and me too. I don't want to dwell on the subject I've raised, you know, but you asked me how.
Oh,
I am,
and I don't think
I'm
you're
just
dwelling. To be honest, William, there seems to be a lot of people coming on my show speaking on the wisdom and the integrity of life and death. And I don't think that's a coincidence, because, you know, I'm a firm believer, having experienced my mother's passing 11 years ago, you know, death is the non-physical. That it, you know, it's by no means, you know, the end for the people who have passed on. It's you know, as Einstein put it, they just change. They're, you know, they might not be physical anymore, but by no means do they stop existing because they're on the other side, so to speak. And like I said, I'm open to the subject. In fact, a friend of mine, one of the nannies that I work with, they were considering putting down the dog, the family dog, for the family that she works for. And she asked me, she was like, well, you know, what do you tell a kid, you know, if you're putting down an animal? And I'm like, my answer was, well, you tell them the truth. I went, you know, this culture is so afraid of speaking about death. And yet, I mean, I'm not saying it's not painful, but death and life are one of the two most natural experiences, you know, that we can come by in this dimension. You know, it's a natural thing that we all know. If we've been born, on some level, we're going to die. And I don't think we should be afraid of it, because I don't think it's something that, in my personal opinion, I've experienced death lucidly, like through dreams and that kind of thing, and I've never had a near-death experience, like where I flatlined, but I've done enough kind of experiences walking between the worlds and shamanic work that I think we do our children a great, you know, injustice to make it seem like a fearful experience. And I also think, you know, when we tell kids, oh, we're just going to put, you know, little Skipper down to sleep, because as my friend put it, she goes, when, you know, if there's ever a chance or ever a time that they're going in for surgery And the anesthesiologist goes, okay, we're going to put you to sleep. You know, the kid goes, you're going to put me to sleep? You know, am I going where Skipper went? You know, I'm never going to come back. And it's like, oh, no, no, no. You know, it's like because we're using words instead of just being honest because there's no shame in death. My mother actually died of cancer, and one of the things she taught a lot of people, and me and more people than I was comfortable with at the time, was I'm not ashamed to have cancer. And like she would, her cancer was on the middle of her chest on her breastbone, and she would wear these like low cut shirts because she goes, I'm not ashamed of what I have. And I'm like, well, rock and roll, Ma, you know, but I'm a little like off balance with you just walking out with this huge black tumor on your chest. And she was like, well, that's your problem, not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
you
no,
know, it
I
was
mean,
a,
you...
go ahead, please.
No, you go ahead.
Well, and it was just a matter of there was such honesty. Now, I was 35 years old, and, I mean, people are like, no, 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 the kids can't handle that. And I'm going to myself, my experience in the 20 years of working with children, children can handle things much better if we tell them the truth than if we start making up these whole scenarios that aren't the truth, that end up, like I said, coming back and kicking us in the ass. Like if the kid goes in for anesthesiology, you know, he thinks if he goes to sleep, he's not coming home because the dog went to sleep and the dog never came home. You know, I'm a fan of realism. You know, I think, you know, speaking the truth to the best of our abilities, you know, children have a sense about the other side anyways. They're closer to the other side than we are as adults. And they have, because my kids, the kids that I work with, have all spoken to my mother. They've experienced my mother's presence. So if they're experiencing that, they clearly know about the other side. So, you know, who am I to say it doesn't exist? And that's my feelings, anyways. What's your feelings, William?
my feelings, I'm not sure that these are my feelings, but... It's some sense anyway that I have is that, you know, we all have a dark side and society has a dark side. And what I mean by a dark side is really conditions that we believe that exist that make us unviable or, you know, that make sort of life untenable, unacceptable, whatever, and so these conditions must not exist in our minds. You know, we have a sense of what must not exist, and a person's dark side is very interesting. You know, because people can think of the term dark side, and certainly before I became a little more conscious or a lot more conscious than I used to be, I just had a vague understanding of this. Oh, there's this dark side, and you know, everyone has a dark side, and the dark side is this part of you that if you sort of uncover, you unleash this monster, that there's, you know, some really creepy part of you that's I don't know, a killer or a rapist or a molester or something that you know, you just got to keep a lid on and control yourself so that this monster doesn't emerge. But what I've since learned is actually, you know, your dark side is any part of yourself or life or your culture or your society that you believe that is a condition that exists, that as long as it exists makes you unacceptable, unviable, something like that. And it's really interesting because what I've learned is that actually often people's dark sides are something very beautiful. You know, for instance, you might be a banker, and your dark side might be actually that you've got a very creative side, that you've got this. I don't just, you know, clutch at straws to make something up here. I've actually met a banker, a very senior banker, one of the directors of one of our four biggest banks in Australia. And I remember his dark side was that, you know, he was a piano player and he had this love of piano playing, but he squashed it because, you know, in his upbringing, if it wasn't viable in the family that he was growing up, where what was valued and encouraged and validated was intellectual prowess and intellectual strength and academic achievement. You see, so for him to be this soft-hearted, vulnerable piano player, that was his dark side. And by the time I met him, he was in his late 40s, and he privately had quite a pain around that. That he was married, he had a family, he had a really good position, but he had this secret, and he would have loved to express it, but it really was a secret. And he did beg me not to reveal it to anybody else, that he had this ability and he had that passion. And I know from a colonial upbringing in Africa, it might sound weird to people, but it's actually true, and it makes a lot of sense if you understand the dynamic, where wherever Europeans went, whether it was to the North Pole and they met Inuits, Eskimos, whatever, or they went to South America and they met South American Indian tribes, or to Africa, or Arabia, or wherever it was,
right?
The big thing was not to go native. That was, and this is a fact, huge lengths were gone to remain, a civilized European person who didn't adopt the thinking or the attitudes or the cultures of the societies that you invaded or explored or went into, And
right.
it was carried out to extreme lengths, where when an Englishman dined alone on his in his house or at his farm or something, he would, even if he was alone, dress for dinner, and if he buttered his bread, he'd use the butter knife and go to enormous lengths to address, adhere to the protocols and the rituals and the mannerisms of the society from which he came. And that's why the society I grew up in was like an exaggerated microcosm of the society we had come from. No one really behaved like we did back in England or France or wherever, because we were just like adhering to our societal norms in a very exaggerated way to appear civilized, you see, and not go native. And so you see, the thing is, and I know this is true of me and a lot of, actually most colonial kids, people are brought up in colonial systems where you see, then you look in subconsciously or unconsciously, you knew what was expected of you. So you look around and you go, well, what's native, So what are the natives? They're very emotional and they express their emotions in a very raw way. So that's native. So don't behave like that. Don't be an emotional person, because that's native. And what else do they do? They're very sexual, and overtly sexual. So bury your sexuality and they, they're very creative in many ways. They're very musical and rhythmic and all that. So bury that, And I'm not exaggerating. This is a fact. And so these, you can then end up with very beautiful aspects of yourself, totally normal, human, and powerful and creative and beautiful aspects of yourself as your dark side. And so I'm just saying, I'm just illustrating how actually, oftentimes the best part of ourselves actually become our dark side and gets buried, and really then our lives become a false life of creating a persona and, you know, ambitions that relate to this false persona that are just designed really to bury your dark side, which can be the very thing that makes you great, where your greatness lies and your beauty lies. But, you know, what I'm talking about here is the dark side. And I just say that as a matter of interest, but because my real point is that, you know, in many cultures and societies, death isn't, you know, while no one wants, everyone respects life and loves life, also death isn't such a big deal. But we can make death more of a deal than it actually really is. You know, we make it part of our dark side, you see. So it's kind of consigned to our dark side, like you were saying. You don't talk about it. It's taboo. Well, that just gives power to the dark side, and then death and everything becomes part of the dark side, and is not an honored and appreciated part of life. And there's a lot to be gained from death. Like I wouldn't want my father-in-law, for instance, to be dead. I mean, if there's anything I could do or pay or give of myself to bring him back to life or to have prevented his death, I would do it. You know, it's just the last thing really that I want. And though he has died, you know, and in fact, I found him. My wife and I actually found him dead. We were the ones that found him dead. And, you know, he'd not been dead very long. And but you know, he died, and we were the ones that found him dead. And that's the reality. And there's a lot to be gained by his death, by being open to it, you know, by just fully embracing it and being really open to it, and also by talking about it, because he was cremated today at just a couple of hours ago, in fact, and we had a little family circle with the kids, and we did exactly the opposite of what you're talking about. We actually did speak about it, you know, and we have before now, and we actually and we will again, because we're going to have his memorial and whatever. But just between my wife and I, Christian and I, and India and Tennessee, our boy and girl, you know, we just now shared our hearts about it, and really, if you sink into and surrender to that loss of a loved one, like, you know, Alan, who really is one of my best friends and my wife's father and my children's grandfather, you know, and if we can, well, as I can do, is just really be with that loss, you know, it really opens us up to another dimension, to another world, where firstly we can really have a sense that nothing dies. You know, it can take you so far as to open you. If you're really with it, you can be in the world, and I think that's the whole thing. You see, with that African culture or relationship with death, of that incredible acceptance of it and taking it on board to that, you know, ultimate extent where you just so open your heart to that pain and that loss and you know, it actually transports you through that. It's like a portal into another dimension, into a life and a world where, you know, nothing dies. Everything, you know, you feel the energy and the permanence of anyway what's substantial, you know, what's true and lasting. Yep. You feel it. And it takes you to that place where there is no loss, because it's in your heart. And it's not just, you know, it's not just some kind of little pleasant thing you say to comfort yourself, are they in my heart? You know, I mean, that can just be like a really meaningless, trite saying. But I mean, to go through to a place where that's a reality, where you are, you know, where everything is connected through all time and space, and you know in your heart that you're not separate, and nothing is separate. I mean, it's quite an opportunity for in our lives where we don't actually. We're so caught up in the process of living and you know, working and playing and whatever and doing whatever it takes to keep our body and our minds together. It's a rare opportunity that you can have an opportunity to have an experience where you really just feel the oneness of everything and the connection of everything through all time and space where it's a reality, and that's a beautiful thing, and it's a privilege, you know, and so then it can be a very worthwhile experience, you know, and also you know not only that, but you can appreciate the value of yourself and other people, the value of your heart, everyone's heart, and just appreciate, like, this is an opportunity where you just go, you know, everyone is so valuable that all the little petty squabbles, well, you know, the squabbles and the things that we don't like about each other, and that counts for nothing in the face of, you know, the truth that you can be opened up to when you really realize how much you appreciate someone and what that person's worth is, and thereby what every person's worth is. So There's just so much gold in an experience of loss as well, and you know, to want to gloss over it, to want to protect people from it, is you know, just another way in which we in our society can just deny ourselves life, really, and deprive ourselves of life, and keep it at its most shallow dimension, you know.
Yeah. Everything you said, I wholeheartedly resonate with all of it. I mean, that was exquisite what you just shared, and I understand. It's so interesting because before my mother died, I had experienced pets that had died, but nothing took me into the portal of the other side until my mom died. Now, I had also experienced like grandparents and aunts and uncles, but without sounding cold, they weren't close enough in my life to affect my life. I mean, I certainly wasn't happy that they were gone, but my life continued on without really much difference because, you know, my mom or my dad would be affected by their passing, but I wasn't affected. Then when my mom died, I mean, it was interesting because what you're saying, I so deeply resonate with. When my mom died, I was it was the first great loss I had ever experienced. And one of the things I knew intuitively was I had in my youth and in my 20s and stuff, I had a drug problem. And I knew people that when they went through something as severe as death, they would either go to street drugs or even, you know, the whole antidepressant and prescription drugs. And intuitively, I knew I didn't want to mask the feeling at all. I mean, I wasn't going to use drugs. I wasn't going to use alcohol. I wasn't even going to use sex, which was, you know, that's a whole nother show. all I knew is that I had to feel all of it. And, like, for me, the wisdom that came through for me was that I'm a right-brained person. I mean, I'm left-handed, so I'm naturally right-brained. But the culture clearly got me early, and I was I'm analytical, you know, and I couldn't analyze my way out of the idea that she was gone, that I could never hug her again, that I could never talk to her again. And then what totally turned my whole world upside down is she came to me in a dream. And she didn't just, like, she didn't just show up in a dream. I went lucid. She spoke to me, you know, on her chest. She no longer had the cancer. She told me she was in a good space. We talked about, you know, where she was. We talked about where I was without her. And you know what I mean? I got to hug her. I was lying on the, ironically, I was lying on the bathroom floor. Don't ask me why that was. Just speaking to her about, you know, how my brother was doing, how my father was doing, how I was doing. And like you said, it literally, I went lucid. I mean, that was not my imagination. My mother came to me in my dreams, showed me she was okay, showed me I could still have a connection with her, a relationship with her, clearly told me that she's like, you were right. You know, my mother's belief was when you die, that's it, you're gone, you get buried, you don't exist anymore. And I used to tell her, you don't have to believe in reincarnation for it to be true. And in the dream, she goes, you know, you were right, and I'm still here. And I'm like, I know, isn't that just fantastic? You know, and then there were systematically other times that she has come to visit me. And, you know, it's like I tell people, you know, especially young people, it's like you have an angel that has a personal love affair with you personally on the other side. That's a guardian angel. You know that angel by name. Anytime you call their name, they know it. They're with you. They're good. If you allow yourself to be supported by just the sheer consciousness of their presence, they will support you. And just like you said, it became a portal. She became the reason I went as deeply as I went into metaphysical, because I now had a reason to know what was on the other side. I mean, when I tell you desperately, we had a very dysfunctional relationship on so many levels, and one of it was that I didn't think I could live without my mom. I mean, I was 35 years old when she passed, and I felt like a three-year-old that lost her. You know, I just, because of all the dysfunction we had in our household, an amazing strength came through me after she passed. And I have told her, you know, since seeing her, that, you know, you birthed me, which was a great gift, and in your passing, I birthed myself, which was a great gift. And, you know,
you were reborn.
I really was, because I could have never known how strong I was until I went through that experience, which is exactly what you were saying about genuinely having the privilege to feel. I mean, oh my God, William, I was so frightened. I couldn't even breathe. I mean, I was just like, how am I going to get through life? You know, my mom isn't here to protect me. And it's like, you know, I realize now you're going to get through life because you're going to become sovereign and you're going to become your own protector and, you know, all those wonderful things that come as life goes on. But, you know, I didn't know that at the initial, and I was really, really scared. I mean, I have been in, you know, tremendously bad situations due to my drug addiction. Never was I as afraid as when she died. That was literally the most scariest time of my life. And, you know, again, it was the great, I was reborn in that fear. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Because people are like, when they hear, you know, they're like, I'm sorry your mom's died. You know, I have friends of mine. My mom was one of those, she hung out with all me and my brother's friends. And they'll say to me, I miss your mom. And I'm like, I don't. And they're like, you don't. I'm like, well, you know, she's still around me. I would have to not see her or know she's around. Then I would miss her. But she is around. And, you know, we have a better relationship since she has passed, because she is spiritual now. And so now we're finally on the same page.
I can relate to that. I mean, I can fully understand that and relate to it. You know, the interesting thing, though, is that while it is true that everything's relative, you know, if you had to take all our passion out of life and our emotions and thoughts and just be totally objectively with the, you know, the sort of the deeper nature and reality of, well, the universe, I suppose, life and the universe There is nothing to mourn, and life goes on, and death is part of life, and you could even say that people live on. But I must say, and it's not just in this instance, there is something that annoys me, really, or that I don't appreciate anyway. I feel like it just detracts from or it demeans or lessens the experience or the situation where you know people will offer you condolences, but then in the same breath tell you that it's all right, you know, like in a sense, I suppose they're trying to fix you, you know, and then just put it all relatively and go, you know, but it's okay, you know, they didn't really, you know, they've moved on to a better place, or you know, that's just life, where people can't just say, you know, I feel for you, or I'm, you know, sorry about that, or whatever, or you know, my best wishes, condolences, or whatever. But where they offer you that, and then in the same breath, you know, just kind of, you know, I suppose in a sense negate what the humanness of it, negate the energy of what was there and what you have. It's almost like saying, you know, that don't worry about it, because that wasn't the real experience. That person wasn't real, and you know, you know, for me, that just goes clunk. I don't know if you know this, but the actual word compassion, I don't know if you know, comes from its root words of common passion, which literally mean to be with suffering. You know, it doesn't, you know, and there's some lack of compassion. Compassion means originally to be with suffering. In other words, I suppose you would say to accept it, be with it. To embrace it, you know, and it doesn't mean, you know, and so it's not compassionate, really, to then go beyond that and make something go away and pretend that it's like whitewashing it, you know, like as if it didn't exist. And it doesn't honor something in my sense, you know, and in my experience. I would rather, for me, when I'm in compassion to someone going through grief or loss, I want to be there for them, you know. But I don't want to whitewash their experience, or eradicate it, or fix it, or relative, you know, just make it all relative and neutral, and as if it, you know, it didn't exist. You know, there's a lack of honor in that, and I think a lack of compassion. I don't want to drag myself down or drag anyone else down, but I prefer for like, you know, if we just use my father-in-law Alan as an example, I prefer, you know, for his memory to be honored. You know, that he did exist, that he did have a place in our hearts. And not for it all to be neutralized and go, well, you know, he was just a holographic image created by your mind. He didn't really exist, or, you know, he's in a better place now, or, you know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. It's deep. What you're saying is really deep, and it's real. It's authentic. And you're absolutely right that it is part of the human experience, you know, to grieve that loss, that person won't be here ever again. I mean, that particular incarnation will never be here again. Exactly. And you're honoring that. And, I, you know, It's so interesting how nobody wants to feel bad in our, I mean, I don't know if this is the same in Australia, but in America, people will do anything to feel bad, including feeling numb as opposed to feeling bad.
Yeah.
You know,
that's,
I mean,
right. And
I see that all the time. No, please go on.
No, I only open my mouth to agree with you. It's very prevalent in our society, and I think we have a lot in common. You know, the Australian, the American, the Anglo-Saxon culture, really. You know, we don't like to feel much anyway, but you know, I think that that we're just based on experiences like this, you know, this is when you really see it, is just how keen people are to fix themselves or fix each other. And, you know, we actually even derive a sense of worth out of, you know, our ability to make other people feel good. And it's certainly certain personality types that think their worth is based on how good they can make other people feel, you know, and rather than how can we serve each other? How can we serve ourselves? How can we serve each other? And you know, one of the, in creating what's highest for ourselves always, one of the most important things is current reality, is being with just how it is, so that we can go through those portals that we were talking about before by embracing fully how it is, or how we feel it is, whatever our sense is, by fully embracing it, that is actually when we go through to seeing this bigger picture, to going from seeing everything as you know, so mortal in the case of someone's death, to seeing the immortality of the aspect of ourselves that are immortal and connected to everything through time and space, you know. So it is through this deep process of acceptance and hanging with reality, you know, and it may be subjective reality, and it usually is, because we always do sink down into a deeper, more objective sense of reality. But to get to that deeper, more objective sense of reality, and also to that space where we're going to be to sink down to a foundation where we're going to be much better placed to have a perspective and actions that serve the higher, to get to there, we've got to go through, I think, you know, and in my experience, really works to fully embrace the reality as far as we can perceive it, our current reality. And it just doesn't serve us in any way to gloss over things and just, you know, move on. It's like we just, you know, it's just like when we tell in our kids, you know, nothing happened, you've just gone to sleep now, whatever, the pet or the grandfather, they've just gone to sleep, or they've just gone to heaven, or something that just glosses it over, you know. How have we served those people? We just reinforce their dark side rather than actually helping them claim their light side, you see. And so there's nothing good that comes from just trying to sweep things under the carpet, put a positive spin on everything, you know, reduce everything down to a relative basis in life or anything like that, you know, we just really keeping ourselves blind. And you know, I mean, if you want to really talk about it, you know, it has an incredible effect on us personally, and then as a society and globally, and the economy, everything is if we don't, you know, really embrace our, you know, current reality, then, you know, we really setting us up, ourselves up for a fall, because as we shrink into this little bubble of comfort and whatever, the dark side, the reality is the dark side out there is expanding all the time, all the time, all the time. You know, and we're just sitting in our little bubble, protecting our feelings and our thoughts and building this emotional stability as best we can all the time and holding ourselves to that. Meanwhile, the reality also is that all the time the dark side is getting more and more power, and that is building and building and building. And, you know, I mean, throughout history, societies are always very surprised when the barbarians arrive at their gates, you know, in whatever form, and or the barbarians arrive at our gates, you know, as a metaphor in our own personal lives, because, you know, we've shielded ourselves from that reality, and by our denial of that reality, that reality grows. And so it's you know, it's just terribly important to be able to claim our wholeness, because it's only through that wholeness, as I say, that the perceptions and the actions that are going to serve our highest are arrived at. You know,
exactly.
Yeah.
No, please keep. I'm a great. You're brilliant tonight. It's a brilliant perspective you're sharing. Unfortunately, from what's happening, but I think there's such a depth of wisdom that, you know, in most cases, people wouldn't come on the show. And I, you know, and of course I would honor that, but by sharing, but you know, this is authentic. You know, this wisdom is not, you're not pontificating this. This is the wisdom, you know, from, you know, what you're experiencing. And so there's an energy and an awareness behind your perspective and your perceptions that is, it's just, there's magic. You know, it is the magician's way, just, you know, not one of the ones in your book. Or maybe it's all of the ones in your book. You know, you always bring a magic to it. Your authenticity is just so endearing. It's endearing. I know that many people will be affected by this. Because one of the things that, I mean, God, I deeply resonate with the idea that a creative side of us can be the dark side. You know, it's like, God, that's so true. Anything we start not talking about doesn't go away because we don't talk about it. It just gets untalked about. It just it's like it settles somewhere. I don't know if it settles in our prostrate or if it settles in our breasts or if it settles in our brains.
It can settle in our foreign policy as a nation, or it can settle economy.
Exactly.
It can settle anywhere, you know. And what's your thoughts in America? I haven't heard the American perspective on this really from people. You know, on the news, we obviously hear your politician's perspective, but
okay.
There's this whole phenomenon, which we haven't heard much about lately in Australia, because the cricketing test matches dominated the news, I think. But, you know, there's this whole phenomenon around this guy, Julian Assange, And the WikiLeaks, you know, where on this website they're just leaking, you know, all kinds of truths.
Yes.
Exposing documents, exposing war crimes, exposing, you know, even embassy opinions on other countries and world leaders. And, you know, it's just this outpouring of truth that is so embarrassing to, I think, particularly the American government, but governments all over the world, you know. Even, you know, in cases where some ambassador to some country had said something highly derogatory about a leader of a particular country, say that the leader of Pakistan or the leader of Australia, you know, obviously it embarrasses America, but it embarrasses these leaders as well. And they don't even want to comment on it. And they're going, oh, you know, it's okay and whatever. And just want to sweep it under the carpet, whatever it was, whatever it related to. And I don't know what the thoughts are in America among the public, but, you know, it's an interesting age we live in because, you know, it's a double-edged sword for our governments because on the one hand, we criticize countries like China or Russia or, you know, that we identify as you know, a bit behind the times, you know, politically and in terms of human rights and freedom of information and all that. So we on the one hand kind of revel in something being leaked about their dysfunction, but when our dysfunction gets leaked, we're unhappy. But what I'm saying is that we're living in a time where it doesn't seem as though personally or nationally or in any respect you can suppress anything. It's very interesting times where just everything's coming out because of the nature of the World Wide Web, I guess, of social media. You know, there's just so many channels now for information getting out, and it does. You know, I always said you can't keep a secret. I'm not a big believer in conspiracy theories, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories that go around. I tend not to believe a lot of them because I just don't believe that it's possible that many people could know about something and one of them not talk about it because it's just human nature to leak things, you know. I mean, if you tell me a secret, boy, I tell you, as much as I promise to keep it in that, if you ever want to get something out, just come to me and say, William, don't tell anybody this, you know. as soon as you've told me that, don't tell anybody, there's this massive urge in me to tell anybody I can, you know.
Yeah,
with the proviso that they don't tell anybody either. But anyway, you know, we're living in this time that's really interesting where everything's just coming out. And I mean, a lot of people, and understandably governments and that, but even, it surprises me, but even among my own friends, there are people that don't like it, that frown on it. But myself personally, I just think it's a really good thing because of my understanding of the dark side and my sense that, you know, we're as you know, dysfunctional as our dark side, you know, as strong as our dark side is, as weak as we are. And you know, I tell you something, like one of the things that came out of this WikiLeaks, for instance, was that we have a defense budget in Australia and a commitment to build up a certain military capability. Now, it's only through these WikiLeaks that we found out that we can't fund that commitment.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Why should that be a secret? We're the voters. We live in a democratic country. And we find out from leaked documents, from a cable from some diplomat in this American diplomat in Australia back to the State Department in America, and then that gets leaked, and that's how we find out that our government actually can't fund what they're telling us, some capability they're going to develop. So we're sitting here thinking, well, we're going to have this, our military capability is going to be X. That's our reality in our mind. And the reality is, and when the defense ministers question on it, he says it's true. He can't deny it. Yeah, he goes into a lot of buts, but this and but that, but brought back to the fact, is it true? Yes, it's true. And in a democratic nation, why are we supposed to find out from a leaked document, from a foreign, cable, from diplomats from a foreign country, that we can't fund this? Just as an example of the truth, there's the truth. Why aren't we, as the citizens and the voters and the taxpayers, whom these people serve, why don't they tell us the truth, And if our soldiers are culpable of war crimes, why don't we know? Why are they keeping it a secret from us? The whole thing with the Nazi Germany and that was the German apology at the end of it was, we didn't know.
Right.
We didn't know. We didn't know. Yeah, we saw them rounding all these people up, but we didn't know. That's the big thing. We didn't know, so
right.
We want to know. If the soldiers from my country, armed forces from my country, are committing war crimes, and they're war crimes as defined by the winners, after World War II, we set up these conventions, the Geneva Conventions and whatever.
Right.
They're set up
right.
by the Americans and the English and the Australians. We defined the rules. They just rules that we defined, So why are we hiding all this from, that's my one point. But the other point, of course, is the point I brought up originally, which is, it's just interesting. We are living in these times where it's just all coming out, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are and, what you hear people think about it, because my thoughts are that as opposed to, I know many governments' positions on this, and even friends of mine, they oppose it. I think, no, but it's just better if there's a lid kept on this. It's, people don't need to know this. It's better for our national security and just our own psychological welfare. We don't need to be exposed to all this muck and dirt and whatever. But imagine that we aren't exposed to it. I mean, what does that breed? And just the fact that people go, and that's how we'd rather have it,
Really makes you kind of scratch your head and go, huh?
Don't tell us about all this nasty stuff that's going on.
Well, I'm actually glad you brought this up. I mean, well, first of all, would it surprise you that when Forbes had a cover of Julian Assange, he is now on my wall. He's my hero. I don't know if that would surprise you or not, but I love Julian Assange. And what I find interesting is, from my perspective, I was talking about this a couple of shows ago with a woman that came on from India, noting that Julian Assange is essentially leaking, information and truth that most of these leaders, no matter what the country, don't want leaked out. But if you also look at the Aborigines, they're breaking a silence too. The shamans and the Mayans and the Hopis, they're sharing prophecies and they're sharing wisdoms that, and I'm talking about, the authentic ones, not these people that are claiming to be Mayans and all that stuff, that haven't been shared in centuries. So it's almost like they're in the same frequency, except they're doing it voluntarily. They're consciously aware that the frequency right now, you can't keep a secret, which is also what I think you're noticing that with your friends. I'm noticing with my friends, even my boss, they're all saying, Goldie, you got a big mouth. And I keep telling them, well, don't tell me secrets. Because my goal is to be transparent.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
my goal. I want to be transparent. And my perspective is those who have secrets don't like Julian Assange. Those whose goal is to be transparent, love them. Love them because exactly like you said, I mean, every point you brought up was so just right on the money. To not know is when we can have holocausts right under in our backyards. I mean, the Germans said they didn't know it wasn't snow, it was ashes. They didn't know. I mean, oh my God. You know, we're burning people at the top of the hill, and they're going, well, it snowed in July. I didn't know. I'm not one that wants to not know. I can't know enough, and it makes me laugh how even friends within my own circle, friends that are having marital affairs, friends that are cheating on, you know, their jobs somehow, they're all, like, screaming at me, Goldie, you got a big mouth. And I'm like, I keep saying to myself, that's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing that I can't keep a secret. It's this projection that they don't even want to look at themselves for keeping this, for having the secret. It's like one of my friends literally got super pissed off at me because I put on my Facebook page that I was going to see him and his girl, not realizing that's not his wife. I didn't know. I just know he introduced me to his girlfriend. Me and her hit it off, and we were going to go have a day of pamper and get our nails done. And when I got up there, he's like, how could you post that? And I'm like, what? I will get our nails done. What's the problem? And he's like, my wife is the problem. And I'm like, well, I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. And I went, listen, the easiest way to do this, just X me off your friends list. Let's stop being friends because I'm not here to watch what I say. I mean, even my boss said to me the other day, she goes, you can't keep your mouth shut. You can't keep a secret. And I went, that's not a bad thing. We should not criticize those who can't keep secrets. But, you know, it's the beginning of the awakening, so to speak, for some people. So they do look at that as, you know, I mean, I see Julian being attacked. And I laugh because I go, he's my hero. And there are certain, because I personally also believe that Julian Assange is a creation from the consciousness of the people who are actually going through the awakening and who want the transparency. I believe they have on some level manifested him. Because like people were saying, you know, he's going to get caught. And then when he turned himself in, they were like, well, why did he turn himself in? And I'm like, because he has the truth on his side. When you have the truth on your side, you don't have to run. The truth is the protection. And, you know, he got out, and, you know, there's a bunch of, what's the guy? Michael Moore was posting some of his bail. You know, it's like all these people who are, you know, honoring his work in the WikiLeaks. I mean, my brother, who's like a staunch Republican, thinks, you know, just like you said, that Julian Assange is a threat to national security. And I keep telling people, the threat to national security are the people that have the power to put other people's lives at risk while they go home in their rich little homes and nothing happens. That's the biggest threat, in my personal opinion. You know,
I agree with you. I think,
you know. Yeah, the haves controlling the have-nots to the point where they can die. I find that to be a threat, and you know, we're so upside down. But the beautiful thing is consciousness is turning everything right side up. That is what I believe is happening right now across the planet. That things are turning right side up, and you know, like my boss she's a nice lady, but there's certain things, you know, like she's still keeping secrets from her husband how many hours I work. And I love her and I honor her, but it's like, you know, anytime you keep a secret, that's a wedge. That's a wedge in a relationship. No, I don't care how you slice it, that's a wedge that, like you said, the more you are afraid of that, the bigger it gets. It just, and inevitably, it's going to pop like a big balloon, and if you're 20,000 feet in the air, when it pops, you're going to land hard. And that's just the truth. You know, and, yeah. You know, I decided when I started doing radio, you know, to start coming out with my truth, because I was like, if I'm afraid of things coming out, like me being a drug addict, I was afraid to talk about me being a drug addict because I was afraid if my nanny's gigs heard it, you know, they'd be afraid for me to take care of their kids. And I went, as long as I'm afraid of it, it's going to haunt me. So I chose to come out and say it myself. You know, because once you reveal your secret, especially family secrets, oh, my God. Family secrets, William, can be, like, wildly destructive. Wildly destructive. I mean, oh, my. I've seen that on many levels, including my own family. And, you know, I'm all for, you know, one of the reasons why I love the Jerry Springer show, I don't even know if you're familiar with him. Okay, he, as much as he was, you know, the tabloids and the fights and all, what he did for the taboo of your average family is he brought out all the closet stuff. He made it okay to be talked about, and I believe that TV show alone shifted the consciousness of people who felt the pressure of keeping the family secrets, and that goes from people who live in trailers to people who live in mansions, you know, because I have seen it destroy families, family secrets, and they wait till people are on the deathbed, and then they come out and they're writing these tell-all books of, you know, mom was abusive and dad was sexually abusive and blah, 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 and it's like, oh, it's so much healthier to do it when they're alive, because then they can get the healing too. You know, in my personal opinion, and you know, you know, there's a lot of energy here. But I love that you brought up that it's really anything you keep a secret, even your gifts. If people who are gifted, you know, gifted metaphysical being, you know, people that have just a natural gift to see in between the worlds and walk between dimensions. They're starting to come out now with, you know, and all their life they were afraid to talk about it because of, you know, if they have, you know, if they were working therapists or, you know, they could have been, you know, like you said, they could have been a banker during the day, but at night, you know, they were, you know, aliens were coming in and having conversations with them. I mean, everything's happening, and as long as we're keeping secrets about it, there's a distortion to what's happening instead of a celebration of what's happening, in my opinion, anyways. But like you said, it's not just Julian Assange. I'm grateful that even the Aborigines, you know, the Mayans and all that, even they're sharing their secrets because everybody is. Once you surrender to the idea that you can't keep them, then all you have to do is own your own responsibility of what you're doing or what you're saying. This, you know, that's a beautiful space to live in if we were all doing that.
Well, you know, secrets is a very good conversation to have, and I'd like to talk about that, actually. I don't want to go over too much old news, but I just want to say this because I find it fascinating. Is that, you know, that Julian Assange is up on these charges in Sweden. I don't know if that's still stand, but last
I've
heard.
Yes, no, I know about that. Right, okay.
And a friend of mine is a highly regarded international journalist, actually, and he's just done a piece on Julian Assange for Vanity Fair. So,
okay.
You know, I had a good chat to him the other night about this, about a week ago. And he was telling me that with these laws that Julian Assange is up against charges for sexual assault, You know, in Sweden, you can have sex with someone consensually, for instance, without a condom, and this is one of the charges he's up against. And then retrospectively, and I literally mean retrospectively, after the event, the woman can decide that it was wrong not to use a condom and claim that she was then abused, which is what's being used against him here. Where it's not a question of consensual sex that's being, claimed here.
Right.
It's a violation of not having used a condom in retrospect.
Wow.
And one of the charges, he's up on four charges. One of the charges he's up against now is lying beside one of these women with an erection.
That's a charge?
That's a charge of abuse, that he lay next to, with consensually cuddling, and he got an erection.
Wow. So, and this is on the books? This is already on the books in Sweden? Meaning this is their laws?
This is their laws, yeah. This is, this is their laws. And, this is more of the truth that's coming up. And, I always had I always thought about, if you wanted free sex and free love, go to Sweden, because that's the home of free love and, free sex and, like this super liberal, sexually liberal nation. And they've got laws like that where you can be charged with sexual abuse retrospectively, even though it was consensual, that a person can decide after the fact that, that wasn't a good thing. I feel violated or abused by the fact that we didn't use
protection.
Yeah, whatever. So it's just crazy.
It's ludicrous.
But anyway.
That's ludicrous. Come on, that's just insanity. That kind of law is so ridiculous.
They're trying to get him extradited for not using a condom in consensual sex and for lying next
having
to someone
erection.
With an erection. Yeah. There are people that would charge you for lying against them and not getting erection. That people be feel very... I lay next to my wife and didn't get an erection, she'd feel very violated by that. She'd be hurt, So, and not to underplay sexual abuse and violation, because that's a serious thing. Don't get me wrong for a minute, this is the thing when you're talking about the haves, and the have-nots, and when the haves are threatened, they will go to extraordinary lengths, As we've seen in the Valerie Plame affair closer to home, for you guys, you'd know all about that. When the haves, and the powerful interests have things to protect, they go, it gets crazy, But anyway, I just wanted to mention that as an aside. I don't know if you were aware of that information.
I was not aware of the laws. I was aware that he was charged, but I knew already in my heart that it was trumped. I didn't realize the law supported the trumped-up charge. Because I do have a little concern with, if that's the law, how he'll get out of it. And I just hope that consciousness prevails. I mean, that's what the truth will prevail.
That's right. It's whether England, and so far they... they gave him bail and he's out in bail, although Sweden challenged his bail. The court accepted his bail because they, apparently, according to my journalist friend, felt that the case against him was very thin we'll see what happens. The point is, it's just not going to stop the truth coming out. The harder you try to stop the truth, the more it's going to pour out. And isn't it interesting, though, that, it's always just who's got the vested interest is for instance, if some country that we perceive as a despicable regime, you know, the Iranians or the Koreans or the North Koreans or the Chinese or something, you know, people that we perceive as violating human rights and all that, we love dirt on them getting out, you know, and we sort of feel like a real victory and a sense of righteousness and that, but when it comes out about us, we don't like it, and you know, it takes us right back to secret. I always was amazed when people would come and do my courses, which are about consciousness, involve consciousness, creativity, you know, metaphysics,
right.
Manifesting, whatever. And ultimately, really, more than anything else, about empowerment, you know, you see,
The
end of the day. And the number of times people would confess to me or let me know that their family didn't know. These were adults, you see. What I would have considered empowered adults, but their family or their friends didn't know they were on a course with me, you know, because of their perception.
Perception
would be if they were doing a self-help or self-empowerment or whatever you want to call it, you know, that they were involved in something where, you know, they were after some self-improvement or self-help or, you know, however you want to characterize it, that kind of like weren't all there or weren't complete in themselves, that they needed to go and do, you know, something to better themselves, that they weren't, you know, okay enough as it is. So it was almost like a sense of shame that they were coming to the courses, you know. And it always shocked me because even it would be, I'd hear it from people who had done a lot of work with me and you know, done very advanced work with me. For instance, just recently a woman came and did a course with me that she was repeating, you see. And she was like, well, she didn't tell any of her family or friends or children or anyone. It was a secret. She had told them she'd gone on a vacation and she'd come to this course because of what she felt it might look like to them that she was repeating it. You see that, you know, the person running course was fleecing her for doing the course again and whatever. And by the way, she wasn't even paying for it because she'd done it before, you know, but the perceptions were that she might be being fleeced, that she might be part of a cult, that she might be, that there must be something wrong with her, that she'd do that she could spend, you know, her time better by being with the family or whatever. And, you know, it staggers me because at the end of the day, what I'm talking about, what I'm teaching everybody is that you create, that your subconscious is the part of you that creates. You see, whatever you're manifesting in your life, there's the side of you that's actually doing the manifesting. And as a premise, for convenience, we call that the subconscious, the feminine aspect of consciousness, and the feminine, the creative principle. So we're just saying, so that's the side of you that creates. And how it's creating, you know, what can very easily be demonstrated in the work I do is that your subconscious creates based on where it assumes the power is, you see. And so whatever you give in the power to is what it creates, you see. And so when you have secrets, whatever that secret involves, you're given the power to. Whatever the idea is behind that secret, you're given the power to is giving the power to that concept or that idea. You know, for instance, you see, like something I share with you, I used to have a substance abuse problem and a big one. And there are people that will try and hide that, and there are people that will be open about that. You see, but if you imagine now, you're on the side that I've got to keep that a secret because then people won't employ me, people won't like me, you know, whatever. It's going to disadvantage me if people know that about me, you see. So then what you're saying is there's a message to your subconscious. Straight away, the most basic message your subconscious is getting, I don't have the power.
Right.
My wishes don't have the power. What I choose in life, what I want to achieve in life, how I want my life to be, that's got no power. So I don't have the power. Other people, other concepts, other morals, other values, other opinions, basically. Because aren't they? They're just opinions. Someone used to be an alcoholic or something. You know, straight away, you've just got an assumption about them. You've got an opinion about them. It's got nothing to do with their potential, how they are now, who they are, what they're capable of. It's in the past, and it's just an assumption. So you say to yourself, the people's opinions, assumptions, whatever, have the power. I don't have the power. And straight away, that has power. You see, that's assigning the power, and it's assigning it outside of yourself. And so then that's the thing with the dark side, you see, is you can say there are things that can exist about me that will disadvantage me in life, you see. And so straight away you're saying, I don't have the power. And one of the greatest ways in which you can disempower yourself in life is by having secrets.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that are not appropriate in life, you know, to go around telling everybody, because not everybody needs to know everything. You know, there are things that are private matters, whatever.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there are people that go overboard and to the extent that then that's dysfunctional. I'll give you an example, you see. I've got a friend who has robbed her children of Christmas. From the beginning, saying Santa Claus is a lie. So I'm going to tell them the truth. There is no Santa Claus. We don't have Christmas in our house and whatever. You know what I mean? So,
indeed.
You know what I mean?
That's part of being a child is the beauty of Santa.
That's, you know, and, you know, look, my daughter is 10 years old, and I gave her $5 the other day for one of her tooth because she actually at some level knows for sure because she's not a moron or whatever. She's an intelligent girl, but she's 10 years old, and she likes the mystery and the fantasy, and she puts her tooth out for the tooth fairy, and she must she knows that there's no tooth fairy. But, you know, I go along with the lie, if you want to call it that, or the illusion, let's call it, and I put $5 there, and I take the tooth away, and... you know, just add to innocence and a sense of wonder and imagination.
Yes.
And that.
Yes.
And you know, I mean, I could give other examples in other areas of life, you know, where, you know, it's just private business. There's nothing served by, for instance, my children knowing everyone's dirty laundry and that. But that's different to the grandfather dog, you know. You know, where you have to hide things that's hurting you, you see, because you're then saying that there's, you know, that this dark side has the power. You're giving power to the dark side. You're saying there are these aspects of yourself, there's truths about yourself or about others or about anything that then, you know, make you unviable, that don't support you in life, you see. And so then that gives your subconscious the idea that what's outside of you that has the power. And that's something I go to great lengths to cultivate, is to give my subconscious the sense that I have the power, you know. And one of, or perhaps the most effective way that you can ever give your subconscious the sense, you know, and the message that you have the power, is by being honest, is by being truthful, by being open, by being transparent, because, you know, that's you know, like what that assumes then is that you have the power. And you know, I just can't tell you how important this is. I just can't stress enough how how vitally important it is. And so when individuals and when politicians and when governments, you know, because the collective consciousness has a subconscious, and so, you know, we collectively create and co-create and whatever. And so when we collectively collude and deny and whatever, you know, we give power to the dark side. We say that the power is outside of us collectively, outside of our nation, outside of our national will or collective will or team will or, you know, whatever, corporate will,
right,
whatever.
Right.
And then what do you see? I mean, I'm asking you to look around in the world now and what do you see? Where's the power? Where's the strength in our experience, you know, in our economy, in our security, in our national security, whatever. It's not in us, you know. It can you can start really seeing a manifest example of what I'm talking about internationally.
Well, actually, can I interrupt, because I can actually speak on something, and it is exactly the manifestation of people taking their power back. I believe is entrepreneurship, like more people, if they get fired, are going into entrepreneurial jobs. And I believe that that's because in consciousness, they recognize themselves as, you know, their being is their sustenance. They don't need a corporation, because the corporations, the governments, they're all kind of coming to the surface where everything that, you know, they're what are they called, those pension plans and Social Security, all of that is, they're starting to realize they worked all their lives and they were promised this by the corporations and the governments, and it's not there.
Mm.
You know, it's like they didn't plan for themselves because they believed the corporation or they believed the government, and now it's time to retire and it's not there. But what I see is unemployment is up, but also there is more entrepreneurial business startups between 2008 and 2011 than like in the past 75 years. And that is, in my personal opinion, another example of consciousness creating. Because when you work for yourself, you know how to create for yourself because you're the creator. You're responsible. I mean, I have worked for myself pretty much my entire life. Not even knowing myself I didn't know consciously that I was creating. I just knew I couldn't work for other people because I thought other people had their heads so far up that I was like, you can't tell me what to do when you're. I worked for a bank from the time I was 18 to 21. And to be honest, I quickly figured out the corruption that was just rifling through the bank that I was working. And it was like, you know, it just quickly told me that, you know, this is not where I want to be. Not even close. I mean, I just knew, because I had a family once, a nanny family. And this is an interesting story. I had a nanny family once. I was taking care of their baby, which ironically, the baby's birthday was 9/11. They were actually in the city the day I was with the baby, the day of 9/11. But I had found packets of cocaine under the couch. Now, she was in marketing, and he was in, he sold concert tickets and sporting event tickets. He had to do with some kind of Ticketron place. So I didn't know whose it was. I think it was the husband's, because I found it, I would find him when she would go away. He would play. So what was interesting is she came home at one point and told me, I don't want you taking the baby outdoors, and when you're indoors, I want you to lock all the doors and not leave the house. And I'm like, excuse me? She's like, yeah, there's been a rash of kidnappings from within houses. Now, William, I was in an exclusive area in Connecticut. You know, and I'm not saying that these events don't take place, but if you're going to live in an exclusive area in fear that they're going to come to your house and steal your children, that tells me it's time to move on. Because I said to myself, first you're doing drugs, and now you're paranoid that your kid's going to get kidnapped. And what's going to happen is you're going to create that. But I don't care if you create that as long as it's not on my shift.
But can I tell you something? There's a strong correlation between cocaine and paranoia.
No, I know that. I know that. But there's also a strong correlation between what you're passionate about and what you create.
Yeah.
So I literally, because remember, I had a cocaine problem. I knew about the paranoia. So I just knew I didn't want to be working for that family, because if they were going to create something and I was working for them, who do you think was going to go down for the fall on that? It would have been me.
Yeah.
And so I've always had this kind of a sense of awareness of what's going on. And when I hear that people are starting up their own businesses, that is a clear indicator to me that people are taking their power back. Because you wouldn't even dream of starting your own business unless you felt self-empowered. You know, that's a no-brainer to I'm not saying it's not a little bit scary, but there's definitely self-empowerment in the whole act of wanting to be an entrepreneurial or an entrepreneur. And, you know, I just read something about that. I don't know if it was in Forbes or Barron. My father gets all these, magazines about the monies, and I'll just sit and, you know, drink my morning tea and open up a page and start reading about, you know, things that I truly don't understand, but I'll catch glimpses of things that, you know, feed me and my consciousness just fine, so to speak. And so you were saying, how does that manifest? And I'm saying, because I agree, I think governments were created to take care of everything we were afraid of. That's why, if they were created to take care of the things the consciousness is afraid of, that makes sense why they're built on fear. They feed off of fear because they were created by fear. But as we come through this, you know, we're coming to 2012, and there's clearly things happening from a planetary point of view, from a solar point of view, from a galactic point of view, meaning where the solar system is. As consciousness itself is shifting, the need for the government, the need for us to even have a subconscious, is becoming obsolete. Because the subconscious is the same as the government in that it's where we would put things we just didn't want to deal with at the time. And I know that from the work that I'm doing. As I live more transparently, I'm recognizing it's not subconscious and conscious and unconscious. There's one consciousness, one. And all I have to do is be aware of my consciousness without being in denial, and then the sub releases everything that I need to experience. You know, it's releasing, like yesterday, it definitely was releasing some rage. Oh, yeah. My body was releasing it, and instead of denying it, I embraced it and, you know, was a bit of a screaming, you know, maniac yesterday. But it's because I have chosen to bring on whatever I have stuffed, bring it on, because I am ready to acknowledge it. I'm ready to own it. And like you said, I am ready to stop letting those things have power, because as I release them, the power is in the grace and the majesty and, you know, the magic that is becoming my reality, which is, you know, way beyond that which my limitations could ever show me, way beyond. And another thing, too, before this ends, is there plans to come to America, New York at all?
Yep, sure.
Okay, because when you come, I'm taking your course. I definitely want you to let me know. I mean, we'll have you on the show potentially if you want. But I very much want to take your course, because your course is a week long, right?
Are you in New York? I didn't even know that. Are you in New York?
Well, I'm in Connecticut. I'm right next door to New York. Like, I'm 45 minutes from New York City.
Okay. All right.
Now, New York is a big state, so...
We'll have a conversation off air, because my team are actually going to the U.S. at the end of the month, and I'll go to New York. So you might like to meet them even. I can catch up with you.
I would be honored. Yes, yes, yes. I would love that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Excellent. Cool. Oh, most. And you'll be there as well, or no?
I won't be there. But my team are going ahead to plan things.
Okay.
And
okay.
What to,
okay, that's fine. Yes.
Prepare our invasion of the U.S. I'm staying at home. I'm finishing off my sequel to The Magician's Way at the moment. So, so I'm staying put. I'm in writing mode.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, because clearly, just so you know, too, anything you ever have to promote, you're so welcome on my show. I enjoy your company, your wisdom. Yeah. I mean, we really have some amazing conversations, and I love them.
We do.
I love them very dearly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's always a good conversation. So, I think this has been the best one yet, in my opinion. Maybe we're just warming up.
Well, I think
up.
We're getting to know each other.
it's a very powerful conversation, this one we've had. I honestly really think it's really at the bottom of everything, the principles that we're talking about now. You can, you know, and that's the thing, you see. People can have all kinds of values and morals and techniques and systems, formulas in their life. But if you don't have a system for transparency and for openness, and also for being with, you know, a system or not a system, but an attitude and a value of compassion as we've defined it earlier, you see,
right,
to be with suffering or you know, just to be with tension, to hang with tension. I think one of the greatest commentators on creativity actually comes from your neck of the woods, Robert Fritz, you know, the guy who wrote the Path of Least Resistance. And he said, if you can't hang with tension, then you can't create. You see, because
oh,
then,
that's brilliant. Yes. Please.
Then you're off in your emotional stability seeking bubble. You know, that's just burying reality and burying actually the portal to what will serve the highest good, you know. And I mean, isn't that what we're all after at the end of the day? I mean, if everyone just, you know, dropped all their crap and just got real and you said, what's it about really? Could you agree with that we're just all here for the highest good of ourselves and everything else? You couldn't put it more succinctly, more powerfully, more honestly than that. That is what we're here for. And the only thing at the end of the day that's going to serve our highest good and the highest good is by being able to hang with tension, by being able to have compassion, to go down to bedrock, to rock bottom, and, you know, really appreciate the bigger picture of what's going on, what you've got to work with, and, you know, what the true direction is. And to have that ability, you know, I mean, to have that creative ability, you have to be able, well, you've got to have compassion, you know, you've got to be able to hang with tension.
Yeah, I think it takes courage as well. I think the courage to be with the tension, the uncomfortableness, and know that it's not going to swallow you up, but it's actually going to transform you into something even greater than before you experienced it.
Mm.
You know, because, like I said, the people that run to the, you know, I mean, I was always a drug addict with street drugs. I have seen the prescription addicts. And I'll be honest with you, I find them much more dangerous than the street. Now, and I get that heroin is very dangerous and crack is very dangerous, but these drugs that turn off all emotions, all sexual drives, it's like it's producing walking zombies. And it's like, you know, people. I've heard people say, I'd rather feel nothing than feel pain. And I'm like, you don't get joy either. You, okay, great. You don't feel pain, but you don't feel joy. You don't feel, you know, excitement. You don't feel curiosity. It's like you feel absolutely nothing. And now, and I've never been on them, but I shouldn't say that. I went on them for 2 weeks to quit smoking. Chantix is one of these drugs. And I'll be honest with you, the headaches that I got were like unbelievable. I was supposed to be on Chantix for 6 weeks. It only took me 2 weeks to be on it because I said, okay, I'll give up the cigarettes because I got to get the hell off this Chantix because it was giving me a headache in the center of my brain. Unlike anything else I'd ever done, it almost felt like, no lie, it felt like it was taking my soul away. I mean, I could feel that, and I just went, I already had a point where I didn't like the taste of the cigarettes. I wanted to quit, so it wasn't about, you know, a struggle anymore. I let the cigarettes go, and I got off the Chantix. And I still to this day have like 3 weeks left, and I tell my friends, you know, if anybody needs Chantix, I got to. If you want to, you know, quit the cigarettes. But these prescription drugs are like, they're very targeted towards like the pineal gland and, you know, the stuff that makes life worth living, in my personal opinion. I mean, that's just my personal opinion. Where, and I know that, you know, cocaine definitely takes you down a very demonic path. Yes, it does. I have been down the path, and I know that. It just didn't feel that way. I don't know. I'm judging. Let me stop judging. I have seen, people think because they're on, you know, doctor drugs, it's like they're not drug addicts. And, you know, truthfully, you're just as much a drug addict if you're on prescription drugs as if you're on, you know, cocaine or heroin or crack. That's my personal opinion, because if you're still not feeling, and the ultimate ascension, you're going to go through your heart to get there. You're not going to go through your mind. You're going to go through your heart. And, you know, everything that was shared here tonight, you know, poignantly states that through the tension, there's beauty. There is benefit in the tension. And I agree with you that this was a powerful show, really, a very powerful show, because people need to hear that from people like me and you who have been through it. You know, we're living the transparent lives. You know, we admit it. Because one of the things you were saying before about, you know, owning it, it's like, because I own my addiction as something I've been through, this is part of what made me so strong. You know, other people look at me, you know, including nannies. I mean, all my nanny families that I work for, they know. And they're like, Goldie, we're impressed that you came back. You know, it's not like I wouldn't get a job from that. You know, do a drug test. I have no fear that I don't do drugs anymore. But that doesn't mean it didn't create me to be who I am, and I don't have compassion for anybody who is willing to start feeling, you know, if they ever wanted to come to me and say, can you help me get off them? Absolutely. Absolutely, because the sense of empowerment you have while kicking a habit like that is also profound. You know, as profound as it takes you into the darkness is as much as it catapults you into the light when you recognize that you're still a good person after all of the negative stuff that you've just been through. You know, I remember thinking I could never think a positive thought again because, you know, I had been so paranoid and so dark in my thoughts for so many years. I didn't know if I could even have or generate a positive thought. And not, of course I can generate a positive thought, but these are the things you think when you're in the negative space, you know. Maybe the rest of the, you know, if I ever got clean, I would still be down, you know, in darkness. And it's like, no, the drug keeps you down there. And then, you know, you just work on kind of seeing life from, because the way I look at it is our brain has like these pathways. And there's a pathway that is a paranoid pathway. Yes. And for many years, that was the trotted path I went. But then magic is a pathway too. And, you know, at first it didn't happen as a first thought. I had to kind of work it a little and really I listened to a lot of magical words, and you know, I read magical books. So I was planting the thoughts. But at this point, it happens naturally. I think, you know, when I'm missing something, I don't think the first thought when I was on coke was, somebody stole it. Because that's the way cocaine makes you think. Where now, the first, if I'm missing something, believe it or not, my first thought is, I wonder if it dropped into another dimension. You know, because things pop in and out of dimensions, it seems like, without rhyme or reason around me. I mean, there's definitely, there's magic happening, and I don't have explanations for it, but I'm no longer thinking I'm a victim of it. Now it's about, you know, opening portals and flying and, you know, becoming multidimensional by choice. You know, I love it. I really love it. And I love the ideas that you always, because you always come back with your book and your class, I already know intuitively, and just by what you said about bringing that magic into this dimension. You know, you're very grounded in this dimension. A lot of the information I take in is, you know, channeled or otherwise, which tends to want me to fly kind of around. But I recognize from years of doing this, if I'm not grounded, I'll be just as messed up trying to fly without being grounded as I was when I was a drug addict. When I want to go to see my higher self, I have to be willing to look at the lower self, at the dark side, because as much as I go high is as deep as I go down, and that is the way for everyone. So, you know, it's good to have a teaching that's grounded in that. And I honor, you know, I honor your magician's way, your magical way. Hello? William? Okay, you're still up on my board. Where did you go? Wait a minute, babe. Let's see. William?
Hello?
Yeah. Oh, no wonder. It's like he's awfully quiet. Sometimes this Blog Talk Radio will mute you. I didn't mute you, but it muted you. Oh, you called back?
Yeah, my line dropped out, so I had to call back.
Oh, sweetheart, I'm babbling my head off. I didn't even notice.
I know. I could hear everything you were saying, but I couldn't get through to you.
Yeah, it was on mute because when you call back, I have to click on your. No wonder why, because I see your number is now. Because you're now on Skype, right? You weren't on Skype when you first called, and now you're on Skype. Is that correct?
I know. I was calling on Skype phone. Yeah.
Oh.
But it's all good. I was just listening anyway. It was only, you know, I was listening. You were doing fine. I thought you'd realize I was.
Yeah, you know, inevitably I turn to look at my computer, yes, and I'm like, where did William go? Of course I notice when you're not talking, my friend. Of course I notice that. What kind of host would I be if I didn't notice that? So
well,
we only
a,
have a couple.
It's been a great conversation. Thanks for having me back on your show, and I do hope we get a chance to talk some more and even meet in New York or Connecticut or wherever.
Absolutely.
You are. Yeah.
Absolutely. First of all, William, you have a lifelong pass on my show. Anytime you want to come on, you are welcome on my show. You're beautiful,
okay.
My friend. You really are beautiful.
Thanks, Calvin. Same to you.
And
thank you.
Yes,
and
I definitely send me the information about your New York friends. I'll go into the city to meet them. Yes, 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 yes. And you know.
Okay, well, I'll put them in touch with you.
Okay, wonderful. Actually, tonight, not a good night tonight, because after the broadcast, I'm going out. But we will talk. We'll set up a time to talk, you know, to get that information. I promise.
Sure. Now, anyway, they're on holidays this week, and they'll be back next week. So I'll get them. They'll be leaving shortly after anyway, so they'll need to get in touch with you next week, and I'll make sure they do.
Okay. Okay. Please. Yes. I would love to even be some kind of help if you want, maybe in promoting, or I would love to be a part of this. If I can be a part of helping you come to this country and to New York, I would be delighted to be a part of this.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. And you know, they'll be the people to speak to. They'll be happy to hear that, and they'll find, you know, some way of, you know, you being able to support us.
Awesome.
Because, you know, I mean, we really are on a mission to bring the Magician's Way to the U.S. this year. That's our mission for 2011.
I love it.
Yeah. It's going to be good. It's going to be fun. And it's also powerful stuff. And, you know, we intend to really make a strong contribution in supporting people, you know, live powerful, open, magical lives. You know, there's really no reason, not to. It just takes a little bit of consciousness, a little bit of openness, a little bit of awareness, and it's amazing how far we can go with that. It's like a very powerful engine. It doesn't have to be running very well, you know, or strongly to carry us huge distances.
That's so true. Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah, that's how powerful it is, yeah.
Exactly.
So, yeah, what can I say? Wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Thank
you. Thanks for having me on the show, and lots of love to you and everyone who is listening to us today. Hope everyone got a lot out of it. And,
they got lots out of it.
Thanks for everyone's energy.
Yeah. Thank you. William, thank you so much. A big hug to you. Many, many blessings to you and your family in this time. And
thanks.
Just keep being beautiful, because the planet needs it, and your shine is real nice. Your shine is real nice. I love you, babe. I love you.
Thank you. Love you, too. Love you all. Lots of love, hey? Talk to you
later.
All
right. I will speak to you soon. Yes. And everybody have a wonderful week. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. And we'll be on again next week. Take care, everyone. Bye.
All right.